It's Wednesday, March 7th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 42 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour. Welcome to Fear the Boot, the podcast that asks the important questions, like who wants a body massage? And gathered here to find out tonight is myself, Dan, and with me is John.
I do.
Mike.
Hello.
Adam.
I would also like a body massage.
And Chad.
I'll take two.
Ooh. I want to know who the second one is going to be from, but we'll come back to that later in the show. Something else important we need to talk about tonight is the fact that our sexually dysfunctional family of Care Bears has added a new member.
It has indeed. We think it's a girl, but, you know, we never can tell.
We have these little plastic Care Bears, and every time we go to a particular pizza place, it's not too far from here, we get another one. They have a machine there that sells them, and they're always arranged in some kind of compromising position. I actually think you can see the Care Bears if you go to our Flickr group. It's flickr.com/fearTheBoot.
Dan just has a thing for Care Bears.
I'm not the one who's sitting with them right there.
Those are my mics. Captain Furry over here who likes the
Bears. Vaguely humanoid, aren't they?
I'm not inviting any of you guys to the orgy. You just don't get it.
They're on your mic anyway, son. So now, Adam and John, we have gotten a complaint about you guys from a particular listener whose name...
We're too sexy.
Have you really? Yeah. And they can't hold him back.
The complaint is that you guys sound too much alike.
Yeah, right.
I don't feel it.
I don't feel it at all.
I can actually see where they're coming from. There's definitely different tonal quality of your voices because John tends to lean more into the mic than Adam does. But
I tend to mumble. Beautiful.
Yeah, Adam tends to trail off and mumble a little bit. John tends to get the
I speak with authority.
Yeah.
Staccato.
You speak with the power of the letter P.
He speaks like the 1812 overture.
And usually when we comment at the same time.
That's true. We often have the same thing to say about the same subject. How about that?
So, John, how do you feel about furries and all their deviants?
Gooey.
Oh, I knew it. Oh. Nah. I got a website for you.
Oh,
time to start saying
probably
the furry
run
point
it.
Of John, too.
Oh, send it on.
Ew.
The Hardvark and I are friends with many, many benefits.
All right, so I missed it last night. But you guys all went over to Scott's place, Scott being Renaissance Wolf on our forums, and had a board game night. And what all were the games you guys were playing?
It was hella fun, too.
The list of games that got played were Arkham Horror and Betrayal
at House on the Hill.
Betrayal at House on the Hill and Settlers of Catan.
Funny side story, while I did not go to this gaming night, I, without any sort of coordination, also played Settlers of Catan last night.
So, we're sitting there, right? And, you know, they're laying out Settlers of Catan, and it's me, and it's Mike, and Jojo Jr. Shabadoo, whose name is also Scott. And I had never played Settlers of Catan before, and I had just read all these reviews about it. So, best board game ever made. It's wonderful. It's the greatest board game ever. And I was like, oh, man, I can't wait to play this. This sounds so cool. And if you've never played it, I don't even want to get into explaining it because that'd be really boring, but it seems a little dull. You lay out these tiles and you have these little pieces and he's explaining how it works. And there's it's basically resource gathering. It's resource gathering and you build things. And the more you build of these things, the more points you get. First person to 10 points wins. And I'm like, God, this is the greatest game ever. I mean, and I had just come from playing Arkham Horror where it's like you don't play against each other and you play against the elder gods and you close gates and it's all crazy and stuff. And I'm like, I just don't know about this game. Then we start playing, and then it's like somebody starts trading a resource. I'm like, well, I'm not going to trade any resources. That's helping the enemy. Gets around to my turn, and I just think, oh, my God, I don't have this and that to build this. But, ooh, I know Phil does, and, you know, Phil's kind of a sucker. So, hey! And then we start working, and I'm like, then it hit me. I understood why Settlers of Catan is the greatest game ever.
That's what it's all about.
It's the wheeling and dealing.
They capitalized on the Monopoly thing. The most exciting part of any Monopoly game is, of course, trying to screw each other, making deals, buying properties.
Isn't there a game where you do just this, like some kind of a stock trading game?
I'm sure there's several.
Capitalism?
Where you yell at each other.
I think it's called Capitalism or Wall Street or something like that.
I'm sure
it's out.
Several,
yeah, it's out.
Yeah, like, that's all you do is, like, you sound an opening bell, and, like, you scream at each other, and then you sound a closing bell.
I bought Axis and Allies, and Avalon Hill had a little fold-out, and that was in it.
Really, in Settlers of Catan, I mean, the game is just an excuse for the wheeling and dealing. Yeah. It puts a framework around it, and it gives it purpose. And it was amazing, and we're making all kind of jokes, and I'm sure everybody makes all the same jokes about Dune. We had bricks, and
You do with the sheep you trade for is always popular.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And then it's like the bricks must flow, and all this sort of stuff.
Your armor of bricks.
It's like bricks were so rare in my kingdom that only the rich and wealthy walked around in clothing made of bricks and stuff. And I was looking over at Adam.
Chad, that's almost a gaming story. Watch it.
Anyway,
it is getting perilously close.
Anyway, I looked over at Adam, and Adam was kind of, he was playing Arkham Horror, and he kind of was like giving the eye, the stink eye to Settlers of Catan. He's like,
oh, you know why the stink eye happened? This is how the whole night lined out. Everybody's like, oh, what are we going to play? So Adam is the first one who says, I want to play Settlers of Catan.
And all of us were like, sit down and play.
Four people behind me are like, I want to play Settlers of Catan. So those four people played, and something else.
Oh, told you I would play Arkham Horror or Settlers of Catan, and you said, go ahead.
Sit down, and then you saw it, and you were like, ew, poo-poo, I don't know about this. I don't know about
that. BS. I played right after you, and it was orgasmic.
And then I was like, Adam, I looked up at Adam in the middle of our game. I'm like, Adam, you have to play this game because I know you. You will love this game. You love to wheel. You love to deal. You love the shiesty aspect of it. And you will love it. And you were like, I don't know about that. And then we're in the middle of playing it. He comes over and he's like, he sits down and he's like, entertain me. We're just like, dude, you got to play. And he's like, I don't know. Finally, we're done with our game.
This is a gaming story.
We're done with our good one.
It is a good one, but it's a gaming story.
We're done with our game, and we give them the box. We give Adam's group the box, Settlers of Catan. We play House on Haunted Hill or whatever it is. And Adam's sitting there, and he's kind of like, no. And then we're setting up. 20 minutes later, I'm not really paying attention. I look up. Adam is in the air. His face is red. He's pointing, and he's yelling, screaming something about wood. And he's just like, I just got Trey. Who's got some wood? Who wants to make a deal? Oh, he was into it. It is an awesome game.
It was the greatest thing that happened to me all week.
It strikes me with board games, you can divide them roughly into two categories. There are those where the gameplay is fun, and then there are those where the primary thing you play it for is the experience of the gameplay. But like with Settlers of Catan, the game itself is not that complicated. All right, but you play it for the experience. It's the standing up and the yelling and whatever.
There's complicated. There's complicated in concept and complicated in execution.
Yeah, that's what I'm
talking
about.
Chess is amazingly simple game.
Right.
It's just really subtle and hard.
Well, I even thought that, like, over the years playing Battletech, that the main thing that brought us back to Battletech so often was the table party.
Yeah.
It wasn't
I see what you mean.
It was the experience of playing.
The social thing around it. You can say that of role-playing games, too, very easily.
Let me put you this way. I would never play Settlers of Catan by myself against the computer. There'd just be no point.
Yeah, and that's exactly.
Even if the computer gave me the most challenging game of my life and I could never win, I'd never play.
Interesting, Dr. Falcon. A game where the only way to win is not to play.
All right, Chad. We've been in suspense. We've been wondering. I couldn't sleep last night, even though I hadn't been told this yet. What is your big special announcement for this podcast?
I don't have an announcement.
Okay, what's your story?
I do have a story. These two yahoos, Adam and John, have been like trying to pimp this story out of me. I hinted that
Dude, we've been one-upping each other, not you. You've had nothing to do with this since it started.
I know. I was just...
Let me paint this picture. So you get into the car and you're like, hey, did you talk to Phil? No. Whoa, well, now that you haven't talked to Phil, I've got this thing that we can talk about on the podcast. Oh, what are you talking about? Well, I'm not telling you. I'll save it for the podcast.
You knew who you went to with this sort of tantalization, Chad.
And then the theories, I haven't even heard any of the theories that's come out of these guys. I can only guess. Tell me, what are your theories?
I don't tip my hand for anybody who's not putting money on the table.
Yeah, me neither. The guy who raises the bet has to show his hand first.
You gotta pay to see my
cards,
that's
a rule of poker.
So you want me to bet you don't know what my story is?
No.
Because I know you guys don't know what my story is.
We're not going to say, oh, this is what it was as soon as you say it. We're not that lame.
I don't understand the bet.
We're making an analogy.
I don't care about this bet. Chad, what is your story?
It is almost not even worth telling now. It cannot possibly live up to the suspense and build-up made it to.
All right, fine. The following story is very, very boring. Have no expectations. In fact, it will probably suck. There. Now, Chad, you have a very low bar to jump.
Yeah. Anyway, last night was the first time that I have ever called 911.
Wow. Why did you call 911?
The reason why I called 911 is we were leaving the game night, and we were going down this road that Scott lives near. It's called River de Pear Road. We come to the stoplight at a cross street called Morgan Ford. It's a red light, and I'm sitting there, and Phil is behind me. And, you know, we're in separate cars. And Phil is behind me. We're waiting, and this van pulls up on Morgan Ford to turn into the lane that we're going to go down. Stops. The light turns green, and we go. The van decides to go, cuts all the way across two lanes of traffic, almost into the third one, completely blocking the road. I slam on my brakes, kind of lay on the horn. The van stops, goes, and then continues on down the road, right? And so I'm behind it, and Phil's behind me, and this van is swerving into oncoming traffic. I mean, I'm not just talking kind of getting close to the line, swerving into oncoming traffic as we're going down this road. I'm like, oh, my God, this guy's got to be drunk or something. All of a sudden, he swerves into incoming traffic and actually hits a car. I'm like 10 feet behind this guy. He sideswipes this car. Sparks fly everywhere, and pieces of both of their cars fly up off of them and onto my car, raining debris upon my car and bouncing off. I actually, you know, reflectively put my arm up in front of my face just, you know, out of, well, reflex, I guess. That's why it's reflectively. And then I'm like, oh, my God. And the one car keeps going, and this guy kind of speeds off. And so I whip out my cell phone, and I'm dial 911. And I'm talking to them and so on and so forth. And then Phil, seeing what happened with this car, and then seeing that I miss my turn because I'm following this guy,
drives into a telephone pole
and explodes.
Man, I'm going to miss Phil.
And he keeps following me, you know, because he doesn't make his turn. He sticks with me. And then I'm describing the van to this person. I'm giving him the license plate, and that sort of thing. I'm trying to tell him what direction we're going and what road we're on and that sort of thing. And Phil pulls up beside me, and he pulls past me and kind of paces the van because, unbeknownst to me at the time, he was on his cell phone, and he was calling the police, and he was getting the license plate number for himself.
So wait, the van is still going?
The van is still
going. This is an attempted hit and run.
It swerves in oncoming traffic, hits this other car, and obliterates it, and just keeps on going.
Yeah.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Until you mentioned Phil pacing him, this was a part of the story I hadn't caught.
Oh, no one had stopped yet. And Phil pulls up kind of beside and back to him, gets the license plate number. And for a moment, you know, because we all know Phil is crazy, I thought, oh, my God, Phil, are you going to try and stop this guy? Are you going to pull, like, a bullet or...
If anyone I knew on this planet would, it would be him.
It would be him, which is exactly why that thought raced through my mind at that moment. And I was like,
I love Phil.
And I was like, oh, my God, Phil, am I going to have to beat somebody up for you? No,
we've got the element
tonight.
Of surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but he just gets the license plate, and then he pulls back behind me where he was. And this guy turns, and I tell the person on the phone, the 911 person, the dispatcher, I guess, that, hey, this guy just turned. He's like, oh, what street did he turn into? There was no street sign, or at least not one that I could see. I'm like, I don't know. It's like an apartment complex. Let me turn in. And like, I think it's the first one after this road and whatnot. And then I'm like, turn. And then I see the sign. I'm like, okay, it's this apartment complex. And then the guy pulls in to like a dead end parking lot off the road. And I'm like, okay, this guy's pulling into the parking lot. Looks like he's going to stop. I'm going to stop following him. And I tell him, it's like, okay, I don't feel comfortable following this guy anymore, because I don't know if this guy has a gun or if he even knows that I've been following him, because this guy's blitzed out of his mind, apparently. And the guy's like, oh, no, that's fine, that's cool. And he's like, hey, thanks a lot, really appreciate it, and gets my name and number. And then I turn around, and Phil had stopped back there because he saw me turn around, and I pulled up beside Phil, and, you know, we rolled down our windows, we were talking about it. I was like, oh, my God, that was insane, and this, that, and the other. He's like, yeah, I called the police. They said they're taking care of it. They said they're sending somebody around. And I'm like, yeah. Then we went home. But that was the first time I'd ever called 911.
I've only called 911 once. And then the one time that I called it. No, actually, I didn't call 911. The neighbor did. I've been involved in situations where 911 was called multiple times. But the one time that I personally called
Carla
it.
Beats you all the time.
A guy got killed.
Really?
Yeah. This was when we saw
Did you plug him?
No, we saw a motorcycle wreck. And the guy died.
Mm-hmm.
But we called 911 back when he was still alive. I'll save that story for a bonus episode, because that'd probably be a pretty long story. So
yeah, it happened back in Nam, and
we've already
crazy.
Had one car wreck story. I'll save that for later.
I don't think I've ever had to dial 911, fortunately. As you said, Dan, I mean, I've been in places where, oh, so-and-so fainted, someone call, but it's never been me.
So let's get into the speculation of what they thought the story was.
I thought it was a pregnancy announcement.
But
Adam?
She's already pregnant.
Yeah, I don't know.
Not
a
pregnancy announcement.
No, a birth announcement is what they're...
Oh, a birth... Oh, I'd call
no,
up
no,
you guys.
No. I know you'd give us... Not a birth announcement. I didn't say a birth announcement. I thought it was like Becky or something.
Oh, that Becky was pregnant?
Yeah.
Oh, because I was like, did you talk to Phil yet?
Well, did you talk to Dawn? You know, there was this whole thing going on. All the shadows were lined up in the right place, but I couldn't look at it straight.
No, I was just saying that because you're always like, oh, don't talk about it. Don't talk about it. Save it for the podcast.
The birth announcement was much more lively. Dawn wasn't there when I got there today, and she's working reduced hours because of her late pregnancy.
Yeah.
You've got everything prepared. I didn't see your emergency bag by the door. The only thing that was keeping me from going full out and accusing
the
you of
the fact that he was here with us doing this podcast?
Dude, we're going
No, not even that. What? Not even that. Her car was gone, and he typically doesn't drive the stick.
I can't drive a stick, yeah.
Yeah, so if he was going to take her to the hospital, he wouldn't have taken her car. His car would have been there.
Mm-hmm.
Or her car would have been there when I got there, and it wasn't there.
Unless
there was a whole process I went through.
Well, but you got to keep in mind, he may have been in the middle of like an instance run in WoW. And so
well,
like,
yeah.
Gone,
honey,
sorry,
it's Dawn. You got to hold that off. You've been doing good for 8 months now. Just what's 2 more hours?
Yeah, I need 2 hours, baby. You got to think of my feelings in this.
Just pucker and hold for a little bit longer.
I really think I'm going to get the Baron mount this time.
Oh, yeah.
You wouldn't want me to miss the Baron mount? That would be the most terrible sign for our kid to be born under.
If you hold it and I get the Baron mount, we'll call the kid Baron.
Oh, my
great.
God.
We'll
call him Rivendare.
Call him first name Baron, middle name Rivendare. That'd be awesome.
That's Rivendare von Badass.
Yeah.
I know a guy named Baron. It's possible.
Mm-hmm.
I got an email this week from a guy who runs a game called Legend of the Green Dragon.
Oh, God. You know, I have an account on that game, and the account is Fear the Boot.
Is it really?
Yes.
Well, he's
is this a BBS game?
And it's the, it's the official one that the company runs, not some other server.
No. Here's the thing. He sent me a saying, and of course, my first thought is this a sequel to Legend of the Red Dragon?
No, it's not.
Whole Legend of the Red Dragon.
It's inspired by.
Right, and it is not an official sequel. I'm not sure who even made the first, but it is a spinoff from it. Because he sent it in and said, hey, do you guys actually like playing text-based games as much as you say?
I sure as hell do. I don't know about you guys.
Well, yeah, because we've talked about Your Mud. We've talked about the Shadowrun Mush that Chad and I used to play on.
Mm-hmm.
During the interview with Mike West, he was talking about playing some game I've never heard of before, but apparently was relatively text-based. And so he's like, if you guys do, you should check this out. And that got me thinking about all the great community interaction, all the great games that we used to play back on the BBS stuff, before the internet was popular.
Trade Wars kicked ass.
Yeah, and this is stuff that goes back.
Legend of the Red Dragon fan,
back
man.
When getting on the internet was like paying an hourly fee that was like $20 an hour to AOL.
Hey, man, I paid $150 for a 14-4 modem, and I was smoking. I was the fastest kid on the block.
That's
Would
so
you
sad.
Tell that story?
I remember lobbying my parents for a 28.8. And being like, well, that'll work.
I like Trade Wars so much that we were actually talking about remaking it. Trade Frontiers that we were talking about. Dan and I actually had been concepting and stuff for this game that we were going to make.
Well, and also these BBS games, unlike bigger video games, are actually feasible for a couple of people to make in their spare time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we need to make Fear the Boot Mud.
I was playing through this Legend of the Green Dragon thing earlier today.
Did you get off the island?
I did. It actually threw me back to my old days. It's like you walk into the inn and flirt with Violet and all the exact same stuff that was there in the BBSs. It was a really different world, though, because of the fact that with the BBSs, it was all local.
Yeah.
You could actually meet these people. You know, whereas like with Fear the Boot, we've got people who listen to this podcast all around the globe. I mean, they're in Europe and Asia, Australia.
And the moon.
The moon, Mars, Jupiter, neighboring galaxies. I got abducted last night by aliens. They're like, dude, we love the Baron.
Yes.
And I'm like, did you just get this probe out of my ass or the Baron's going to come find you?
He is totally a celeb on the infernal planes.
So, John,
yeah.
During these banter topics, you were supposed to throw out some kind of a comment about a movie.
Oh, yeah.
And it was supposed to be spontaneous, but you just completely dropped the ball there.
Well,
so, we're going to have to script it. What's your comment?
I have three criteria for a movie to be my best movie ever.
Okay.
And I saw one today that fit them.
Two,
but
Blade
it wasn't
Runner. Three,
my best movie ever. Chad, you might be onto something. Number one. Has to have Rutger Hauer.
Oh, yes.
Number two, okay. It has to proceed in an incredibly slow pace. And
I've
number three,
seen it.
It has to end with an elevator door closing. This movie is called Breach.
I've never seen Breach.
It's also called
Breach. Actually,
Blade
up until
is that the
elevator door?
Yes.
Yeah, I haven't
Ryan
seen
Fleet
it yet.
Movie, right?
Yeah, it's supposed to be really
yeah,
good.
Yeah, it was actually very, very good. Really? But I was just like, this has so many things in common with Blade Runner.
Up until the elevator, it sounded like Split Second. Which is one of the best B movies I've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
It's a terrible B movie, but it's an
greatest
excellent
line
B
movie. Ever. They're going to fight the alien, and then they actually decide to do it. Has Rucker Howard and stuff.
We actually
and they
can't actually, quote this line, but
they actually decide to do it and stuff. And they go into the police armory because they're cops, and they're like, "We need the biggest guns you can have." And he's like, he takes out a 357 Magnum. No bigger. No bigger. And he takes out this automatic grenade launcher. Why the police have this, I don't know, but who cares?
He's Roy Batty. Come on.
And he's like, "This thing could level a forest." And he's like, "I need bigger."
It was wonderful.
It was great.
It was brilliant.
So, John, give us the highlights of Breach real fast, because I was actually thinking about going and seeing this, but it looked kind of,
If you're going to see it, don't get the highlights.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, no spoilers. No spoiling
highlights. Let me think about
this. If you're going to sell this to us.
If I was going to sell this to you guys.
Okay. Slow.
Actually,
I think you did with
elevator.
The three criteria. Yeah. John, I was just about to ask
Rucker
you,
Hauer,
hey, you want to go see it again?
A very small part. It's
then I'm not interested.
It's very much a...
Well, Rucker Hauer played a small part in Batman Begins.
That's true, but he was still awesome. He played a huge part in Blade Runner. Anyway, about the question you're trying to fish out of me. It's slow, but it's subtle and dramatic. It is not the James Bond spy movie. It's actually how a sting might go down in Langley, if it came to that, even though
isn't
they're
the
FBI
one about the
and
Russian spy and they're...
No, he's American. He was selling stuff to the Soviets through the 80s, and they couldn't catch him red-handed and lock him up until,
the Robert Hansen
2001.
Movie?
Yes, it's
this
Robert Hansen.
Good.
It opens up with a picture of John or a clip of Ashcroft going like, "We nailed this guy." You have to remember that America's always under threat from foreign attack, and this is, March 2001.
Yeah.
So, a little foreboding.
Yeah, I knew of the movie about Robert Hansen, but I didn't.
This is him. Chris Cooper, the horse guy from the trainer from Seabiscuit, is the spy for the Soviets.
I'm sorry, I never saw
it. Did you just reference Seabiscuit?
I know, I can't believe you just draw a
Seabiscuit is good.
From Seabiscuit to Rucker Hauer.
You're the Seabiscuit.
This is
you guys just don't like thoroughbred racing.
I love chocolate cake because it's the exact same color as manure.
Well, I guess
did any of you see it?
Accurate, but
yeah, that's what I thought.
Seabiscuit, is that with Aragorn? Viggo?
No, that's Hidalgo. I saw that too.
Oh, that movie was bad.
That one sucked. That one sucked ass.
You got a thing for horses?
No.
Wait, was that the one with Kurt Russell and what's
No, I had Tobey Maguire.
They had Tobey Maguire.
Not horses, ponies.
Oh, this movie sounds good.
I don't like horses. I like gambling.
It wasn't
so
very good.
When it's about thoroughbred handicapping, hooray.
Mm.
When it's about running through the desert and going on adventures and getting your chopped off, no, not so much.
Well, there's an
Yeah, that's in Hidalgo. It doesn't happen, but
Screw
it's threatened
that. That's
multiple
in Hidalgo?
Times.
Yep. I'm glad I haven't seen this.
Yeah, you don't need to. There was this whole rash of mediocre movies out in, late 2004.
From 1980 to 2006.
No.
I'm not a big fan of that Viggo Mortensen either. I always make the comment that his chin, I feel like he's mooning me because he's got that split chin. I feel like it's his ass.
He does have a big butt chin.
Yeah.
He does a really good Aragorn. That said, I'm struggling to find a role that I liked him in that was not Strider the Ranger, and I can't do it.
Yeah, the only reason I can't hate him is because Lord of the Rings, it had its flaws, but overall was such a...
Yeah.
It was flawless. It was the
such
best movie ever made.
Damn solid three movies that I have trouble hating anyone who was in it.
Except Sam and Mary. God, they were annoying, but I love that movie. Those movies otherwise.
Well, I need hobbits. more John Rhys Davis supposed to be every day.
Not all of them were that annoying, though. Just those two.
No, they're hobbits. They're inherently...
The grumpy one back in the Shire that was always glaring at him was not like annoying. He was a very conventional, proper hobbit.
That's fair.
He had nothing to do with adventures, as is good and just. He started getting drunk at the very end. That was good. He finally loosened up at the bar.
Well, Sam, Bilbo, and Frodo, I mean, they had the little Hobomo thing going on, but other than that, they were fine. But Sam and Merry kept ruining everything. I was just like, God, my... Throw them off a tower, drown them in a river, get rid of them. They're just a total dead weight.
You talking about Merry and Pippin?
What was your perspective on Pippin?
What did I say?
Sam and Merry?
Oh, yeah, I meant... Oh, excuse me. That needs to be cut.
That's two edits.
Yeah.
Oh, excuse me. Me and my flat mouth.
You said synonym for male genitalia. You talk about somebody getting
what
their...
What did a doll go...
Yeah. it's about getting their bleep cut off.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that was bleepable.
Yeah, that is absolutely bleepable. Man, you guys all, it's like you have this Tourette's thing where you can't stop yourselves from swearing.
All you head and shoulders.
You. Okay. Whoa. Sorry, Whoa. Mommy.
What are you lumping me in with the riffraff for?
Yeah, I guess that's true. I don't think you've ever done it. The other three have, but I don't think you've ever done it. Adam, I apologize.
Not true, I have.
Oh,
have
I'm sorry, I'm not once. G-rated. I'm not Pollyanna.
Yeah, you're not self-controlled is what the issue is. That the
fear the nanny state.
That's right.
No, I'm not scripted. I'm totally off the cuff.
Fear the iTunes delisting. Anyway, getting on to the game design topic for today.
And no one wants to talk about games. Let's talk about something else.
I believe this is actually the last episode, I think. There may be one more. So it's either last or second to last of the kind of math and rules-oriented game design topics. After this, we're going to do a couple shows on stuff like publication, rights protection, marketing, all the post-production sort of concerns, which you probably need to think about during production. This is stuff that really doesn't come into play until post-production. Today's topic is going to be the other side of combat. So we're going to talk about wounds, healing, and death.
Bad things.
With wounds, we're going to have to keep it a little bit brief because we actually talked about wounds in the last episode, which we actually did not intend to do. We just got carried
Someone
away.
Someone got moderator happy.
Yeah, we just got...
You just can't control yourself when you talk about wounds. It just comes out.
You open your mouth and wounds come out. You can't even control yourself.
All these little four-letter words like wound. That was five. Shut up. Like, yeah, shut up.
If I could open my mouth and spew forth wounds, I would be the greatest person that has ever lived.
That'd be a character I need to play.
You got a little bit of wound on your
chin. I think they call those wizards and sorcerers.
All right, so let's talk quickly about wounds. We mentioned last episode that you could make your choice about whether you want to have hit points where really there is no such thing as wounds. You're just draining this pool, and there is no difference between all of your hit points and only one left. It's basically your two states are fine and dead. On the opposite side, you try to be super realistic and talk about injuries where when you get shot, you don't lose 10 hit points. You get a pierced lung and a chance of infection. And there's games in between, like Shadowrun, where you have hit points, but the loss of those points actually does degrade the performance of your character. We talked about kind of deciding where you want to fall along that line.
Shadowrun would never try to do two things at once that it shouldn't, would it, Chad?
Ew, Shadowrun.
You know, Mike, since you've been on the show, I don't know if we've gotten your input on this debate. I like Shadowrun. Chad and John hate it. Adam's never played it. Where do you fall on this?
Well, in the bonus episode that you were trying to introduce me, but we were talking about cigars instead, we did talk about this a little bit, and I said that I do like Shadowrun. It's just, it's fine. It's cool.
You've knocked us into a dead heat. Adam's
it depends on how it's
party.
Run, though, yeah. Like
if
everything.
If we could turn him, we could win, Chad.
When Mike puts you in heat, you've got a problem.
We're gonna.
When I put you in heat, excuse me? What
dead
are you talking
heat,
about?
No
dead
less.
Heat.
Dead heat, yeah. That's talent. I mean, I can't do that.
All right, so let's move past what we did talk about into some things we didn't talk about related to wounds. One of them is permanent injury. I have seen it in role-playing games. It is not common. When you get shot, that wound lingers. And in its most simple, brutal form, this would be like dismemberment, that you got hit with a lightsaber and off came an arm, and it ain't coming back. But there's
Unless you're a Trandoshan.
There's also some...
Boom!
Or
but
a troll.
Anyway.
You should not know that.
Don't question my Star Wars.
But also, it's not just that. I mean, for example, you get shot in the chest and you permanently have trouble breathing and that affects some kind of stamina in the game or whatever. I've never seen a game that does that. I'm sure they're out there.
I think there's nothing a player hates more than a permanent hindrance to his character.
We were playing a game one time where Dan was running it. One of the players in the game got shot And it was one of our homebrew ones, and he took a permanent injury, and it was something along the lines of a minus 1 or 2 points to hit with a gun or something, you know. But it was permanent.
Yeah, I got you.
And to him, the character was unplayable.
Absolutely. Oh,
it
dude.
It was done. It was like...
This is actually Skies of Glass.
Yeah, it was Skies of Glass, and this guy was like...
He got shot in the foot, and the foot wound went south terribly. Yeah, like Chad's saying, it was a really minor thing. Like, his character was slowed down a little.
Was yeah, it was just trouble like walking. Minor.
But yeah, he was done.
Next time you're running D&D, lock one of your characters in a room with, like, a zombie or something that'll wound his hit points, and lock the other one with a white.
That'll drain the levels.
Make player one take all of his hit points down to one, and make player two permanently lose 100 experience points, and see which one is more pissed.
Well, it's a catch-22 because you want their danger to be real, but at the same time, what's the fun in playing Helen Keller in a role-playing game?
But the thing is...
You don't have to make it Helen Keller. You can make it guy with a broken leg.
Yeah. Well, but point is having, you know, disabled character.
I think that there's levels to it. I think that when you take some injury and you have some minuses to you, it's representative of life. Life is not all advantages. As you progress through life, you do not get... It's not like D&D. You don't get stronger and stronger and stronger and more godlike, unless that's your game that you're trying to run and play. But on the other hand, I think that you can get to a point where you get so blown away game after game after game. I lose my left arm. Then I lose my right arm. Then I'm, you know, and you turn into the knight from Monty Python.
Yeah.
And
right. I think a lot of this is situational choice, though, too. Yeah. I mean, okay, don't get into a sword fight with the Billy Badass Ninja Samurai who's been cutting people's arms off for 20 years.
The Black Knight didn't have to get into
a sword
fight.
But I want to get into a fight with that guy and beat him because it's my role-playing game, and I want to win and crack his bones.
Well, I mean, you need to be prepared for that reality.
Yeah, big-time feel issue here, as with so much stuff we've talked about. Feel of the game itself, and then also feel of the individual campaigns that someone wants to run. Like, within Skies of Glass, it's our intention that combat is supposed to be absolutely brutal. And because of that, you can die readily, you can have wounds that do horrible things to you, and a lot of people are going to be turned off by that because they like the idea that in every game they can get into a firefight, and if they get injured, no big deal. You just apply a stim pack and back come your hit points, and you're good to go again. It's a question of feel, because within Skies of Glass, the point is that combat, it's like real life. I mean, in real life, you don't want to get in a firefight, because if you get in a firefight, you might get shot.
Yeah.
And getting shot is not something you could just sleep
on. I don't want to get into a fist fight, because I might get punched in the face. I've been punched in the face. It isn't pleasant.
Right. But in something like D&D, this is intended, because of the fact that you are supposed to be the hero who goes through the dungeon, slaughtering the goblins, and then comes out and faces the dragon, and then rescues the maiden from the wizard, and has all these adventures, and someone that is losing limbs to the goblins is not going to have too many more adventures.
Yeah. How do you think the goblins feel? I mean, you hack them to little bits.
They don't have souls.
Yeah.
The leading theologians from the Church of Pelor have utterly dismissed that prospect.
You know, if they had souls, they wouldn't burst into a little 100 XP thing that numbers that throw out.
And little money bags wouldn't drop when they die, which I pick up with a pleasant blinging sound.
Nice little shift right click on the ground.
Next step after wounds is, of course, healing. And healing brings up a lot of the questions that wounds do. For example, the more realistic you are with healing, the worse that it is. Real wounds heal slowly, and while they are healing, there's this nasty stage of convalescence where you are not up to par and are not performing well. Someone who's just been shot, even if they're healing and on the mend, is still not going to go out and gallivant around town doing all kinds of wild things.
Oh, yeah? I used to watch Cops all the time. And there was
any point that starts off with "I used to watch Cops all the time" is the qualifier for authenticity.
I used to watch Cops all the time, and they did the L.A. and all this gang warfare and stuff, and they kind of did from the perspective of an emergency room. And they brought this kid in, and he had been shot 30 times with 45 caliber rounds. So basically, somebody took a MAC-10 and emptied the entire clip into him, and he had bullets all the way from his feet, all the way up his body and into his head. And they wheeled him in, and they removed every single bullet. And then they brought him around, and as soon as they brought him around, he got up and walked out the door.
When you make the cops role-playing game,
I saw that Captain Picard had like half his body removed and Borg stuff in it, and they healed him.
That proves you're wrong, Dan. That proves it.
That's right. Everyone who's been shot bounces right back out of the emergency.
You know, just I saw this movie one time.
They just flex until the bullets pop out, and then they run back into the field.
Pop, 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 pop.
Healing is a complicated thing. Yeah. Just as complicated as injury is. And, of course, obviously, it depends on the kind of injury you receive. And also, if you do healing where you have the potential that someone could be laid up in the hospital for weeks or months,
that's
of course,
an exciting role-playing
game.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right there.
You may be screwing up the role-playing game because even if it's accurate, what is the fun? And the rest of the party gets to continue on while you spend the next 6 months in the hospital.
An insane nurse is euthanizing patients one by one. Your bunkmates are dying. You think you're next.
Okay,
go!
Now that's an exciting role play.
That would be fun.
Now that could be useful, though, if you know a player is about to go on a vacation, have him suffer a big major wound, and they have to lay in the hospital during the next
few
games.
I wouldn't be a big fan if you're about to go on vacation, so I'm going to forcibly gun your character down.
Yeah, that's lame.
The character you like doesn't have an arm anymore.
No.
3 months of physical
therapy
for you.
Have a nice vacation, bitch.
He's taking pills to make him docile. If you ever make a DC 24 save, they don't work.
I'm just saying, if you were going on vacation, you could take the bullet for the team.
Well, that's metagame crap at its finest.
Yeah.
You know, a problem with like wounds and stuff rolling on charts and whatnot is that you take a wound and, you know, there's the possibility that you die, but then you just take wound after wound after wound after wound till the point you're just ridiculous. You're a walking wound, for lack of a better joke. But
that's what Mike's talking about, the Helen Keller game. Yeah. You can get to a point where your character is so broken.
At what point do you break that off? From a design standpoint, at what point do you define that for the GMs?
I don't know. I mean, of course, within a lot of games like D&D, they just cruise right around it because it doesn't happen.
Well, and the healing is magical, and the wounds just close up.
Right, you just close up and they go away.
Even if you don't have magic.
Yeah,
if you just sit in your bed for a while with no medical attention, you'll just get better.
As soon as you're out of combat, you start regenerating health.
That's something else a lot of games do that I always thought was kind of screwy. It's like first aid, and this depends on the game, could just bring back hit points or bring back health.
Well, they revised that in D&D. It can't bring it back anymore, but it can stop you from bleeding out and actively dying.
Right.
Which makes more sense.
Yeah, which is what first aid does.
Yeah.
It stabilizes and improves your chance of healing. It does not actually heal you on the spot. It's not like if you're dying, the ambulance shows up and all
of a
sudden.
But yeah, like especially in these online games from Ultima Online to World of Warcraft, you have
my bandage
the bandages and you just get better.
You're a bandage spec rogue. It's awesome.
I am.
Well, that begs the question of, I mentioned before, magic, because it kind of trivializes wounds, not like bandages. I mean, obviously, magic has at least some reason to bring back hit points, whereas bandages really don't. But it kind of trivializes the danger of the game and wounds in general if magic can just heal it up.
Yeah, and once again with this, man, just feel. If this is intentional in your game, you're like, with my game, I want combat to be regular. I want it to be a big part of the game. I don't want players sitting parts of the game out healing.
I want the dynamic of character classes covering for one another, one of which must be a healer.
Then, and if that's the case, hit points is the way to go. Magical healing or healing skills that regenerate hit points is the way to go.
And if you don't want to play trauma center the game.
Right. And I'm not saying, just because I'm a big fan of realism within games, but having said that, I don't think it's appropriate for every game. So I hope nobody's getting that impression from what we've said over
the past few episodes. I'm a big fan of realism in games. I'm not a big fan of mountains of paperwork either. You get shot once and you run away. Okay, now we're going to spend the next hour and a half rolling on charts to see if you live and how you're maimed and re-editing your character sheet and making all these changes.
What MechWarrior did that cut the difference between these possibilities was I think they actually did have injuries, but the injuries would only occur on like certain kinds of hits. You had to hit these points for like, you had hit points for your character as a whole, and then I think you had hit points for each location. And like on critical hits, or if you exceeded the hit points of that individual location, now you could actually get into a lasting, lingering injury. So you could get them, but it took quite a bit to get there. And I guess that was their way of trying to keep them somewhat rare, so they were possible, but you didn't have the game where you're just walking around eyeless, toothless, armless, legless.
I think you want the threat of that a lot more than you actually want it to happen a lot.
Well, it makes it cheesy, too. I mean, we had a game where we played where one of our other players made a character from the start that was, deaf and mute and blind and whatever else he was No, you know who I mean.
He just didn't have a tongue.
Well, but now we're getting into character creation, and it's not a combat thing. It's not as if he got attacked by a troglodyte and lost his tongue.
Well, I'm just remarking that I'm just remarking that having disabled characters can add an element of cheesiness to the game, too, depending.
It can also add an element of roleplay. It can add a little complexity to it, I think.
I mean,
guess it depends on how it's done.
You have to learn how to deal with role-playing game, Charles Xavier. Interesting character.
True, true. Again, it depends on how it's done. If you're all Charles Xavier's, that would be a little bit...
Then you can go to the wheelchair Olympics and kick
some
butt.
Yeah, the thing is, that's not a... Yeah. I mean, I guess if you're designing a handicap Special Olympics game, I don't know. But, I mean, again, that gets back to character design.
I think the threat alone of injury probably adds a lot of color to the game, like John was saying.
Yeah.
Because people are so not going to want it to happen that one of the complaints I've heard about role-playing games in general from some people, and other people would say this is intentional, is the fact that there's no fear in them. That you have no fear about charging that dragon because worst-case scenario, I lose a few hit points. Of course, some people say, well, that's intentional because I want to play the hero. I want to play the guy who's fearless. But other people say, you know, I think that that's just cheesy. It's not terribly believable. And the idea that I can walk away from this dragon missing a hand or with a permanent...
Well, is it incumbent upon the game system you have to instill emotion into your character? Because fear is an emotion.
I don't think not entirely, but yeah, certainly. It plays some of the role.
But is it incumbent upon the system to make your character feel happy and sad?
Well, I think you're creating a false dilemma here. I don't think to say that your game should play some role in this is therefore to say, well, it's entirely incumbent upon the game. Yeah, I think absolutely, yeah, the nature of the story, the emotion, this has to come from a cooperative effort between the GM and the players to create a story and to create emotion. But certainly the game can play a role either enabling or inhibiting that or guiding the kind of emotion.
I see the game as only being able to create fear, reward happiness. I don't really see it as that's the game's job. I mean, the game provides a framework for combat and a framework for non-combat things, provides a method of creating a character and defines in using different metrics the definition of that character. And I don't know. I just don't see it as, you know, there's the dragon and the game should somehow be a part of, there should be rules in there. It's like, well, okay, we're playing this system, and if we play in this system and I charge the dragon, I'm going to be a little afraid of what's going to happen to my character. But if we play this system, I'm not going to be so much afraid of what's going to happen to my character. So in one system, I'll charge the dragon, and the other, or at least think about it. In the other system, I won't even care. I'll just charge it. Well, you have to play the character. You have to play it in character.
If my Bene Gesserit sister goes to charge the dragon, she's not going to feel fear because she knows.
She knows.
Fear's the mind killer.
Well, but I think, the little death.
The in-characterness, to some extent, comes from the game mechanic, because in D&D, if I'm playing a 15th level fighter, the in-character fact is I am this inhuman hero. Whereas if you do the same thing in a game like Shadowrun or a game like Battletech or whatever, the in-character reality is I'm not all that.
Well, to combat this, what do you guys think about, like, GM-imposed fear to tell the players you're afraid and to give them penalties?
I don't like it, because that's the slippery slope to, well, you don't want to do that.
You walk into a room and there's a beholder, and the beholder has this mechanic of fear.
If the guy has to blow a fifth-level spell to cast a fear on you for four turns, whatever, that's one thing.
But, yeah, I don't like puppet mastering players.
Moving away from fear back into healing, this actually does describe a mechanic that you could use to also bridge these two possibilities of healing between nonsensical healing and the characters in convalescent centers for the next 6 months, which is you could simply have or suggest that the game master should do something to describe this, that if a person gets shot, even if it is just you lost 25 out of 50 hit points, that you still kind of nudge the characters to play out that, they're limping a little bit or whatever on the return. But I think the problem I've seen with that is that it tends to become an issue of convenience, that when nothing's going on, you talk about how your character's wheezing and can hardly move.
Yeah.
But the moment the Citadel's under attack, suddenly you find that energy to spring back into action as if nothing had ever...
That always happens.
That's a playstyle issue. And I have seen that happen, definitely, to where I've had to lay the hammer down and say, no, your character has this injuries and you are not the superhero that you were two games ago. And then on the other hand, I've seen it really well played out.
Yeah, Chad, sometimes you'll demand a role and sometimes you won't.
Mm-hmm.
Like with my gambling addict priest, You never made me roll to resist betting, but sometimes he had the fortitude of character not to, and sometimes he didn't.
Yeah.
And you just tossed the ball my way, and it was a good game.
It's a give and take, yeah. And because I trusted you with that.
Yeah.
Now, if Phil had done that...
That's true.
God love Phil. You did it because it was an interesting character quirk.
Yes.
Phil would do it because it's a min-max thing.
And he could get another attack modifier.
Exactly. And he would never have it come up unless I forced it. So if it were Phil in that situation, oh, every time he passed anybody who even looked like he could make a bet with, he'd have to make a roll, which I wouldn't like doing.
So play to your characters maybe more than your game, or rather your players rather than your characters. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, making Phil do that, I kind of dissuaded him from doing it because, again, I don't like puppet master. Even Phil, I don't like puppet mastering Phil's character.
Description can help too a lot. Rather than puppet mastering, if you can describe the scenario more, if you can describe the wounds that that you suffer from.
Now, I definitely think that's something that the game system can do. Is if you have wounds, go beyond just saying, okay, you get shot, you roll on this chart, you have this wound that gives you -5 to hit. In that chart and in that description, you know, write something that's interesting. It's just like, it is this kind of wound and it looks like this and it's festering or whatever. It doesn't even have to be extreme. And, you know, there's different levels of it and stuff. And maybe even just provide suggestions for role playing. Like, you got shot in the leg, so you have kind of a limp, or, you know, on rainy days it hurts. You know, little role-playing hooks for your character game design can add into that. Instead of just saying, you rolled a 6 on the wound chart, you now have -4 to hit. Oh, boring.
I agree with that. I think you've got to draw a middle ground, because if you're too descriptive, you can push the game into a new level of sort of nonsense. Like if you say, you got a punctured lung. Well, now you have to get into, okay, what actually happens with a punctured lung? This actually does this, and this is the kind of medical attention you need. And these are
balancing act.
These are the possible complications.
And your character turns from the heartthrob, romantic, computer hacker, orphan to punctured lung man.
Let's go to the next possible stage of this, death. Death is probably...
I will never die.
You know, I would say death is stickier in games than injury is, but I'm actually not sure it is. I've seen people pitch less fit over their character dying than their character being maimed.
Well, of GMs are much more ready to injure their characters rather liberally than they are to kill them. So you might have seen the dice rolled many, many more times on the former issue.
It's tough, though, because what do you do if you have a really great character that you spent a lot of time on, you've been role-playing really well, you're really into, he gets along with the party really well and is part of the group template really well, and now he's dead?
What do you do if you have 50% of your players in your group are like, let's do sudden death. If you get shot and you die, you're dead. In fact, I want my character to die 10 games in and I want him to die this way. And then the other half of the group is like, no, I spend way too much time on this character. You can injure him. You can punish him. You can knock him back. I don't want the character to die because I put too much work into him. I don't want to make another
one. That's a call I have to reserve for myself as a GM. And I know not everyone does. A lot of people go to their players, which is a good angle to take.
Yeah.
But your character can die in my games, period. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. If that bothers you too much, there's lots of other gaming groups.
Well, I think the design mechanic you really have to look at to play into this is how easy is death, simply put.
Yeah.
The easier death is, the more shallow your characters are going to be, just because it has to be that way. If you get real attached to your character, well, they're just going to keep dying.
Yeah, but I can't get into the mentality of someone who isn't afraid of death.
Well, I'd say that's partially right, because I'd say it's going to cause one of two things. If characters die easily, either you're going to have a reckless and violent group or a reckless and violent plot where people are going to stop putting depth into the characters because they're turning them over every two games.
Where one man will go and charge a dragon.
Or... it's going to hit a point where, because you are afraid of death, you're going to start questioning, maybe we shouldn't try and do this. There's a dragon down there, let somebody else deal with it, we're going to get killed going down.
Balancing act again, yeah.
Beyond that, I mean, I like that in a group who says, well, maybe we should, because you can do role-playing situations with that. My problem is when you have the sudden death, brutal game, and the players are like, okay, we've done all this role-playing, we've decided to go forth with this plan, and that's where the plot takes, that's where the game is going. But if we die, we have to make a new character, and we maybe put 100% into the first character, we're going to put 90% into the second character, going to put 60% into the third, and then if they have four deaths, they have Phytor.
Yeah.
What's the character's name? I don't know. What do you want it to
be? Or another possibility that doesn't even have to wait until death is they're so afraid of death, you just get this Richard Pryor game where all they are is scared. Where it's like, do you guys want to go out and venture? No. No way in hell. Because if I go out there, I could get stabbed. If I get stabbed, there's a good chance on this chart, I'm either going to get tetanus or gangrene, and then I'm going to lose the arm, and then it's going to spread, and he's going to die. There's no way in hell I'm
and
doing anything.
We're playing Cthulhu, so Ted over there, he's got a low sanity. He's going to see me die. He's going to lose it. That's the end of Ted's character.
So you could hit a reverse extreme here, even within the game, where you have people so afraid of death or injury, they won't do anything. And maybe that fits the feel of your game.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to think that, generally speaking, that extreme does not. Though I'm sure there's exceptions to this.
Those sound like a lot of decisions to be made, though, on the gaming group level, not the system level. I mean, if you want to play a lethal game, don't play a lethal system.
Well,
simple as that.
That's a pretty convincing argument.
Yeah, but ultimately it's hard when you really like the setting of the lethal system.
Yes, so the mechanic still expresses this, though, because when you sit down and make a game, either the characters have tons of hit points and weapons don't do much damage, or the characters don't have many hit points and weapons do a lot of damage. I mean, you are creating a mechanic wherein death is either extremely easy, extremely unlikely, or some shade of gray in between the two. And so this absolutely does fall upon the system. Now, the gaming group can choose to ignore or amend that, and they can choose to run the game in a certain way where the conflict has a certain difficulty.
But the rules have to look at the feel, like our feel is that we are a very heroic game where one guy charges the army and slices through 100 guys. So we are not going to do brutal mechanics because that will never happen in a brutal game. And so your rules have to point the feel to that. Now, once the person buys the book and runs with it...
Right, they can choose to do whatever the heck they want with it.
Yeah.
I mean, we've mentioned in, I believe, the previous show, how with MechWarrior, we reduce the number of hit points a character has, because otherwise the game, we think combat's not brutal enough. I've seen games go the opposite direction, where we just kind of have to say, you know, we're not going to do that. Like in D&D, I pretty much never use level drain, because I think it's too cruel.
It's nasty. If I use it, which is basically never, I make some sort of resource, whether it be an item or a friendly higher-up cleric, available to patch it up for him when it's all over. Because that is, as we said earlier about experience point drain, it's the truly permanent wound, and people hate it. Yeah. I hate it. Everyone hates it. I'm not saying that derisively. I do, too.
One thing you also got to ask about death is, in your game, what does it take to go from alive to some middle state to dead? For example, in D&D, you have basically three stages of character existence. You have alive with some number of hit points, which could be one or could be a million. It doesn't matter. It's all the same. You hit zero, you're unconscious. So it's negative one now, you're dying. And when you hit negative 10 plus your constitution modifier, I think.
Really? I think it's just a flat negative 10.
I think it's just a flat negative 10.
I don't. I thought it was hit also above your constitution modifier. I could be wrong.
I think your constitution helps you stabilize as you're slipping naturally down the negative numbers, but 10 is the
I could be wrong on that. But you hit some negative number, and then you're finally dead. So you got to decide, do you want some mechanic? And this can also help you avoid death a little bit, because if you have some gray area between the two, you can now, within the game, as a game master, say, all right, the bad guy shot you. He did enough damage to put you into comatose or into unconscious or whatever this middle state is. But now that you're down, he's going to ignore you and not keep shooting the body. So this allows you to not kill characters so readily without cheesing the enemies to where they're just spreading their shots around for no discernible reason.
I do that in D&D. I mean, if they're playing an intelligent opponent who thinks he's going to beat the group, he's not going to waste the next stroke of his sword on the guy he just cut down, who may or may not be entirely dead. He's moving on to the ranger after he's killed the fighter or whatever.
I don't know if we'll do this in Skies of Glass or not, because we haven't entirely decided how we're going to use luck. But one of the things that I did in another game I wrote was I allowed for something called a death averter, which allows characters to buy off their mortality in the worst situations. For example...
And this is total metagame, right?
Yeah, this is a total metagame idea. But you, in this particular game, you accumulated these advancement points that you could spend to improve your attributes and skills. And if you had enough saved up, and it took a pretty large amount, you could give up those advancement points in return to buy off your death. So if, like, you're in the corridor, and some guy rolls a grenade up to your feet, and it goes off, and you've got 50 hit points, and this thing just did 250 points of damage. You can't possibly survive it. If you're willing to dump those points on the Death Averter, then the Game Master is supposed to employ a metagame sort of dynamic, saying, all right, at the last moment, you kind of jump behind a door frame or whatever, and this thing went off, and you are near dead. I mean, you are as close to death as a human being can be, but you are not dead.
We had a similar mechanic in some of our games. We had a death-saving throw where there would be an opposed D20, which in more brutal games was modified to a D20 versus a D6. Yes, a rather stacked throw. At any point that your character would die, you got that to get to the point of just nearly dead, but not quite.
It sounds ridiculous until Phil rolls against his own mortality and lives.
Yeah. Oh, no, the D6 beat the D20 more than once.
In a row. And not even fudging the dice.
No.
Wow. Straight dice in front of everybody.
No. Boom. On the rare occasions that we were actually watching Phil for his
well,
GM, it still worked.
At least with my Death Averter scheme, you still lose something meaningful. In fact, you lost a significant amount of advancement points. It'd be like in D&D, giving up half of a level. Or
yeah,
something
yeah. With your system is much harsher. Ours is just a... But yours is a guaranteed get out of free card.
If you want,
ours is the luck of the dice.
If you're willing to squirrel away those points, it's a guaranteed fact, but you still have to squirrel away those points and eventually part with them to make it happen.
On the other hand, dying is also a very significant loss of points as well, because your whole character's dead.
Yep.
Within Skies of Glass, I think we mentioned last episode that we are indeed going to use a wound system. Probably on the Tier 1 rules, we will just have generic hit points, and there might be some minimal chart for stat degradation, but it's going to be pretty simple. At the Tier 2 and Tier 3 levels, we are going to start involving actual wounds, where when you got shot, you're going to have penalties on your character to reflect that. Something else we wanted to try and do was to keep our eyes on the actual natural process of healing, because of the fact that you don't have magic in Skies of Glass, and a lot of characters are not even going to have access to good, solid medical technology.
The Tier 4 rules, we actually ship a gun with the game.
Right.
When somebody takes a wound, the Game Master pulls out the gun and plugs them.
And then you ask them how they feel.
How does this affect your character emotionally?
In fact, the entire Tier 4 rule system is just three words. Call the police.
That's a great new spin on running horror games, too.
It is. Well, you want real fear? Bring a gun.
One of you players is not leaving here alive. Yeah. Oh, Matt sucks. I worked hard on my character. No, you didn't.
No.
One of the players is not leaving here alive.
You gaming in Missouri now. This is high stakes gambling, boy.
So what we are probably also going to do is to look at, when you take a wound, is the wound getting better? Is the wound getting worse? Is it complicating? At the really high levels, we may even get into things like infection and such. But once again, that's the feel of our game. Skies of Glass is supposed to be a brutal survivalist game. This is not the same kind of mechanic I'd recommend for every game. And even other games I have written, I did not use this. I just kept a simple hit points and relatively rapid healing because it did not fit what I was trying to convey. So just be sure to pick what's right for your game. For our Skies of Glass Q&A today, we are kind of paraphrasing a question to get at a deeper issue. Guy on our forums by the name of Francis.
Whose real name is?
Also Francis. And we know him outside of the forums as well, but he just asked a good question. So
hi, Francer.
We'll run with this. He wanted to know how we were going to handle futuristic technologies that relate to combat. For example, he was talking about these body armors that are a couple years away in development that involve all these ballistic gels
that hardens and stuff.
And the answer is we will handle these similarly to how we are handling all the other future tech within the game. We are going to try and look up some of the things that are on the horizon development-wise and maybe even push them a step beyond that. But given the fact that, for the most part, society has been reduced to an industrial level of technology, we kind of get a cheap way out of this because we really don't have to represent it. Because that kind of super sophisticated stuff, the powered armor and laser weapons and et cetera, et cetera.
It's wrecked.
It's wrecked. I mean, we might define it because we have to, because there are places that have it. And it is conceivable that in the course of a game, maybe somebody would come across it. We generally don't think they should. But
probably wouldn't work. But
maybe
somebody
would come across it. But we are going to try and avoid defining it in great detail whenever we can, because we realize in the process of doing so, even if we do the best research we possibly can now, 20 years from now, people are going to be snickering at what we described.
Quite correct.
Even in, like, in Shadowrun, someone was telling me in 4th edition, they just now finally made the Matrix wireless. even up until, I guess, third edition, if you wanted to get on the Matrix, which is their equivalent of the internet, you had to go find someplace and plug into the wall.
Well, you have to jack in with your big head helmet. I mean, this is law.
Exactly.
Come on.
Exactly. And there are super-powered computers with these huge rigs, or even today our computers are getting smaller and smaller. You can't get around that, because you just can't predict where technology is going to go. So we're going to do our best to represent that, but when we can, we're going to try and just leave that in good Hitchcockian fashion, more up to the imagination of the reader. We're just going to imply things and let you imagine that how you like, to avoid embarrassing ourselves. And where we can't, we'll just do our best. So I guess that wraps it up for this episode. Thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Booth. This show is copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in the show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.